Imagine it's early May. You are looking at the agricultural markets, and a completely unprecedented, apocalyptic weather system has just stalled over the entire American Midwest.
Oh man, just a total disaster scenario.
Exactly. It is washing away roads, flooding silos, and completely wiping out the current available supply of corn. Now imagine you are the procurement manager for a massive multinational cereal company.
Right, so your job is entirely on the line here.
Your job is on the line, yeah. Because if you do not secure physical corn today, your factory is shut down tomorrow.
And you definitely don't care what corn might cost in July or September.
No, because if your factory shuts down today, your company is losing millions of dollars a week. You will pay any price, literally any price, to get your hands on whatever physical corn is left right now.
Yeah, whatever is sitting in an undamaged silo somewhere, you're buying it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what happens to the math of the market in that exact moment? It doesn't just go up, it actually it breaks the fundamental laws of market physics.
It does. It completely detaches from future expectations and becomes entirely about immediate, desperate survival. The entire structure of time and pricing just it flips upside down.
And understanding how to trade that flip and, how to recognize when it's happening is exactly what we are dissecting today in this deep dive.
It is wild stuff, but so important.
It really is. But before we get into the absolute madness of infinite profit loops and market physics breaking, I want to quickly mention that this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel.
Oh, yeah, absolute lifesavers for studying.
Truly, if you're listening to this, you are likely staring down the barrel of the Series 3 exam. And CertFuel has a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Which is huge because you need that real-world feel.
Exactly. It's incredibly helpful for locking in these dense topics. You can check them out at CertFuel.com. Keep it casual, but yeah, definitely check them out.
For sure.
Okay, so for you, the listener, trying to conquer this exam, we are looking at a topic today that is going to haunt your dreams if you don't master it.
Oh, it will haunt your dreams and destroy your score. We
Wow.
need to be very, very clear about the stakes here.
Yeah, lay it out for them.
Spread questions account for a massive, disproportionate chunk of part one of the Series 3 exam, and part one spans about 71% of the entire test.
It's practically the whole thing.
It is. You simply cannot pass this exam if you are guessing on spread questions. But here's the good news. While they seem incredibly complex on the surface, they all follow a very strict, logical set of rules.
Right.
Spreads live or die on one concept, direction. But it's not the direction you think it is.
And that is the core philosophy I want you, the listener, to lock into your brain
Right.
right now. I know from my own trading experience, when you first start out, your brain is entirely wired for absolute direction.
Oh, totally. Like, is Apple stock going up?
Exactly. Is Apple going up? Is the price of crude oil going down? But when you step into the world of spreads, you have to completely aggressively unlearn that instinct.
You really do.
When you trade a spread, you are trading the gap between two things. You are not betting on the overall market direction.
No, you don't care at all.
Right. You do not care if the whole market goes to the moon or crashes to zero. You only care about the distance between point A and point B.
It really is a paradigm shift. It requires a completely different analytical framework. Because, I mean, most people come into commodity trading thinking, I need to know if gold is going up.
Yeah, the flat price.
Exactly. Spreads throw that absolute flat price right out the window. It is entirely about relative value. And because this can get, incredibly abstract very quickly, we are going to ground this in physical reality.
Yes, please.
We need to visualize the actual people pulling the levers in these markets.
Yes. To keep this from turning into a dry, sleep-inducing textbook lecture, we are going to use a recurring cast of characters today. I want you to picture these three people because they represent the three core forces of the futures market.
Okay, who's up first?
First, we have Farmer Fred. Fred is our commercial hedger. He deals with the actual physical commodity. Picture a guy in muddy boots out in the fields dealing with broken tractors, unpredictable weather, and giant physical piles of grain.
The real world guy.
Exactly. He does not care about getting rich on a speculative trade. He just wants to lock in a price so his farm doesn't go bankrupt.
Right, he's just managing risk. So our second character is Speculator Sally.
Okay, tell us about Sally.
Sally lives in a high rise in Chicago and has literally never touched a single grain of corn in her life.
Not once.
Never. She doesn't own a silo, she doesn't own a tractor, and she absolutely never wants to take physical delivery of thousands of bushels of grain in her penthouse.
That would be messy.
Very. She is entirely focused on placing directional bets on the price action. She is the risk taker. She provides the liquidity that Farmer Fred needs to hedge his crops.
Perfect. And finally, we have Arbitrage Andy. Andy is essentially the market policeman.
The enforcer.
The enforcer, exactly. He doesn't speculate on direction like Sally. He doesn't grow crops like Fred. Andy is an institutional algorithmic trader with massive amounts of capital.
Wall Street money.
Huge money. He just waits for the mathematical relationships in the market to get out of whack. And when the math breaks, he swoops in to exploit the free money. And in doing so, he actually forces the market back into line.
Right. He fixes the math by exploiting it.
Exactly. So Fred the farmer, Sally the speculator, and Andy the arbitrager. Keep them in mind. So with the stage set, let's look at the foundation of all of this. The bedrock of spread trading is something called the carrying charge spread, which is driven entirely by the cost of carry.
Well, we should probably define the terminology first, because the exam writers are going to throw multiple aliases at you just to see if you actually know what the underlying structure is.
Oh, they love their trick words.
They do. A carrying charge spread might be referred to on the test as an intra-market spread, an intra-commodity spread, an inter-delivery spread, or a calendar spread.
Okay, inter-calendar. That sounds like a corporate scheduling nightmare.
Oh, seriously.
If I'm sitting in the testing center having a mild panic attack and I see intra-market spread, what am I actually looking at in plain English?
It just means you are taking two opposing positions, one long, one short, in the exact same commodity on the exact same exchange, but in different delivery months.
Okay, so give me an example.
So the classic example, you are long May corn and you are short July corn.
Got it.
It is all corn. It's all on the Chicago Board of Trade. The only variable that is changing is the date on the calendar.
So if I'm speculator Sally, my instinct from trading stocks is just to buy the closest, most volatile contract like May corn and be done with it.
Yeah.
Why am I complicating my life by shorting July corn at the exact same time? What is the actual point of building this two-legged structure?
You're doing it to hedge out systemic risk, which we often call the flat price risk.
Okay, unpack that.
Let's say you just buy May corn. You are completely exposed to every single macroeconomic event on the planet. If the Federal Reserve unexpectedly raises interest rates by 2%, or the U.S. dollar suddenly skyrockets in value, the overall price of all commodities, including corn, might plummet.
Right. Everything tanks.
Exactly. Mm. If you are just long May corn, you get wiped out. You lose a fortune, even if your specific thesis about the local corn supply was totally correct.
Okay. So the spread acts as an isolator.
Precisely. By going long May corn and short July corn simultaneously, you insulate yourself from those macro shocks.
Because they offset.
Right. If a broad market event happens, let's say global recession fears cause all grain prices to drop universally, both legs of your spread move together.
So the whole market shifts down.
Yeah. The overall price of corn shoots down. Your long May leg loses money, but your short July leg is making money as the price falls. The broad macroeconomic move essentially cancels itself out.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It is. This isolates your position, so you are only exposed to the microeconomics of the gap between May and July.
Which brings us to the most important question of this entire deep dive. Why is there a gap at all? Why wouldn't May corn and July corn cost exactly the same amount?
That is the million-dollar question.
I want to pose a ridiculous hypothetical to you, the listener. Let's go back to Farmer Fred. Imagine Fred has just harvested 5,000 bushels of corn. And for some bizarre reason, he decides he doesn't want to use a proper facility, so he stores all 5,000 bushels in his living room in May.
Which is a terrible idea, by the way.
A horrible idea.
Yeah.
But his futures contract doesn't actually require him to hand over that corn to the buyer until July.
Yeah.
What is holding that corn for 2 months going to actually cost him?
Well, his living room is going to be structurally compromised, for starters. The floorboards are ruined.
The rats will love it.
Exactly. But in the real world of commercial agriculture, this scenario illustrates what we call the cost of carry. Holding a physical commodity over a period of time is not free. It actively drains capital.
Right.
First and foremost, you have storage costs. Fred can't use his living room, so he has to rent space in a commercial grain elevator or maintain his own specialized silos.
And that's not cheap.
No, that involves a monthly rental fee, electricity for aeration fans to keep the grain from rotting, and of course, labor to manage the facility.
Right, it's not a digital stock certificate sitting invisibly in a brokerage account on your phone. It is a massive, physical, degrading asset. You can't
Yeah,
just leave it out in the rain.
exactly. The physical reality of the asset dictates the market structure. Second, you have insurance. When you have $1 million worth of corn sitting in a highly combustible grain elevator, it needs to be protected. You have to insure it against fire, against flooding, against tornadoes, and against pest infestation.
Because it's literally giant piles of fuel and food.
Right. And those insurance premiums accrue every single day that the grain sits there.
Okay, so storage and insurance. And the third cost, which I think is the one that trips up most test takers because it feels less tangible than a giant grain silo, is interest.
Yes, the financing cost. This is the opportunity cost of capital. Let's say Farmer Fred has $100,000 worth of corn sitting in that silo. That represents $100,000 of his capital that is completely tied up.
He can't touch it.
Exactly. He cannot put that cash into a high-yield savings account to earn interest. He cannot use that cash to pay off a high-interest loan on his combine harvester.
Or more realistically, he probably borrowed the money from a bank to buy the seed and fertilizer in the first place, right?
Yes, and he is paying interest on that loan every single day he doesn't sell the crop.
So storage, insurance, and interest. Those three elements combine to form the cost of carry.
Correct. And understanding that allows us to understand the normal shape of the market. Because of those three cumulative costs in what we call a normal market, the deferred month, the later delivery month, like July, has to trade at a higher price than the nearby month, like May.
Okay, let me make sure I'm walking through this logic
Sure.
correctly. If I am the cereal company and I am buying corn for delivery in July, I am essentially forcing Farmer Fred to hold on to that corn for May and June. I am forcing him to pay the elevator rent, pay the insurance, and eat the interest costs for those 2 extra months. Therefore, Fred is going to bake those costs into the July price.
He has to, or he loses money.
Right, the July price inherently embeds those holding costs. So July corn will mathematically always be more expensive than May corn in a standard, well-supplied environment.
That is the exact mechanism. The market compensates the entity storing the physical commodity. That structure, where the deferred months are progressively more expensive than the nearby months, is the strict definition of a normal market.
Also known as a carrying charge market, or a market in contango, right?
Yes, exactly. Contango. I am going to throw a massive exam trap alert flag right here for the listener. This is one of the most common ways the exam will try to trick you. The test makers love to play semantic word games.
They really do. They're sneaky.
Very sneaky. If a question gives you a scenario and says, in a normal market, the nearby month is trading at a premium, do not just nod along and accept that premise. That statement is fundamentally false.
Completely backward.
In a normal market, the deferred month is at a premium. The deferred is higher. If they tell you the nearby month is actually higher than the deferred, that is a completely different, highly volatile scenario. That is called an inverted market.
Right.
Do not let them trick you on the definition of normal. Normal means later is greater, later costs more because time costs money. That is a critical distinction. You always have to anchor yourself to the physical reality of the supply chain. It costs real money to hold physical things over time, so later dates must cost more under normal circumstances.
Okay, so we've established the foundation of the gap. May corn is cheaper than July corn because July has 2 extra months of storage, insurance, and interest baked in. Now, I want to ask you, the listener, a direct question. Pause for a second and really think about the mechanics here.
Give them a second to think.
If the gap between May and July corn represents those specific holding costs, can that gap just widen to infinity? If there's a massive glut of corn, can July corn eventually cost $10 more than May corn or $100 more just because the gap keeps widening?
The answer to that is a hard mathematical no. And this brings us to the concept of the ceiling. The gap in a normal market can only widen to a specific threshold, which we call full carry.
Full carry.
Yes. Full carry is not an abstract concept. It is the exact calculable mathematical sum of the storage, insurance, and interest for that specific time period. And why can't the gap get wider than full carry? This is where Arbitrage Andy enters the picture.
The market policeman. I love this part because it shows how institutional forces keep the market from breaking. Walk us through Andy's heist here.
It really is a heist.
Let's use some real numbers so the listener can visualize the trap. Let's say the actual physical cost to store, insure, and finance a bushel of corn from May to July. The full carry is exactly 50 cents.
Okay, 50 cents.
But suddenly the market gets panic about a future supply glut, and speculator Sally and all her friends start aggressive trading, pushing the price of July corn to a full dollar higher than May corn. The gap is now a dollar, but the cost to carry is only 50 cents. What does Arbitrage Andy do?
Andy looks at a screen, sees that 50 cent discrepancy, and his eyes light up because that is guaranteed risk-free money.
Free money.
Literally. He doesn't have to guess about the weather or global demand. He just executes an arbitrage loop. Step one, Andy instantly buys the artificially cheap May futures contract. Step two, at the exact same second, he sells the artificially expensive July futures contract short.
Okay, but wait, he's a Wall Street guy. He doesn't want physical corn in his office.
He doesn't care because he's a purely mechanical participant.
Mm.
He lets the May contract expire, meaning he takes physical delivery of the cash corn in May. He gets the warehouse receipt.
Okay, so he owns the actual corn now.
Right. Step three, he pays the 50 cents per bushel for the commercial elevator storage, the insurance policy, and his internal cost of capital to hold that corn through June.
And then?
Step four, July arrives. Andy takes that exact same corn he's been storing and delivers it against his short July futures contract.
Oh, wow. So let's look at his profit and loss here.
Mm-hmm.
He captured a $1 differential between the two contracts when he put the spread on. He paid out exactly 50 cents in physical real-world carrying costs.
Yeah.
He pockets 50 cents per bushel of pure, unadulterated, zero-risk profit.
Precisely. And here is the crucial macro effect of that action. Because it is a risk-free arbitrage, Andy is not the only one doing it.
Oh, right. Everyone's doing it.
Every major commodity trading advisor, every hedge fund with an arbitrage desk, and every major commercial grain company sees the exact same free money. They all execute the trade simultaneously.
It's an avalanche.
Yes. They buy massive amounts of May corn, which mathematically drives the price of May corn up. And they sell massive amounts of July corn, which mathematically drives the price of July corn down.
And what does that do to the gap? It squishes it. That massive tidal wave of institutional buying and selling forces the two prices back together until the gap shrinks exactly back to the 50 cent full carry mark.
Exactly. The moment the gap hits 50 cents, the free profit disappears, the arbitragers stop trading, and the market stabilizes.
That arbitrage mechanism acts as an unbreakable physical ceiling. The gap between two delivery months simply cannot widen significantly beyond full carry. It is mathematically impossible as long as there is physical storage capacity available.
Spot on. That is the ceiling.
Okay, so that establishes the ceiling. The gap can only get so wide before the arbitragers slap it back down. But what about the other direction? What happens to the floor?
This is where commodity markets get truly fascinating and where the most extreme volatility lives. There is no floor.
Wait, what?
The floor does not exist.
Wait, explain that. Why is there a ceiling but no floor? The market loves symmetry, doesn't it?
It loves symmetry in theory, but not in physical reality.
Let's go back to the apocalyptic scenario we used at the very beginning of the episode.
A weather disaster.
Right. It's early May. A historic flood wipes out Farmer Fred's farm and every other farm in the Midwest. The commercial silos are severely damaged. Suddenly, there is absolutely zero physical corn available for immediate delivery. But the demand hasn't changed. The cereal companies, the livestock operations feeding millions of cattle, they still need that corn today. If they don't get it, the cows starve.
Exactly. The immediate spot demand is incredibly rigid, but the nearby supply has completely vanished. In that environment of pure commercial panic, the price of the nearby May corn contract is going to skyrocket. And here is the structural key. It can skyrocket directly over the price of the deferred July contract.
Because, quite simply, you cannot feed July corn to a cow in May.
No, you cannot.
If you need it today, you will pay literally any price for it today. The future price is completely irrelevant to your immediate crisis.
Right. The market becomes inverted. May corn might trade at $8, while July corn sits back at $6. And here is why there is no floor, why that gap can stretch infinitely. Arbitrage Andy cannot step in and fix this.
Why not? If May is at $8 and July is at $6, that's a $2 gap. Why doesn't he just reverse his heist, buy the cheap July corn and sell the expensive May corn?
Think about the physics of that trade. Andy buys the cheap July corn. He gets the warehouse receipt in July, but he sold the May contract short.
Right.
That means he has to deliver physical corn in May, to execute that arbitrage, and he would have to take the corn he receives in July, put it in a time machine, travel backward 2 months, and deliver it in May.
And last time I checked, the Chicago Board of Trade does not have a time travel desk.
Sadly, no.
Time only moves in one direction. You can store a commodity forward through time, which creates the full carry ceiling, but you cannot borrow a commodity backward from the future to solve a shortage today.
Exactly. Because you cannot arbitrage backward through time, there is absolutely no mechanism to cap how high the nearby month can go over the deferred month. During a true supply squeeze, the market can become extremely inverted, and that gap can stretch infinitely in the inverted direction.
So to summarize the structure before we move on to the actual trading strategies, the ceiling is capped by full carry because of forward storage arbitrage. The floor does not exist because time travel is impossible.
That's a great way to remember it.
That asymmetry is so foundational to everything we are about to discuss. All right, pattern interrupts here. Shake off the math for a second. Let's pivot to placing the bets. We've talked about the structural cage, the gap, the ceiling, and the floor. But how does speculator Sally actually structure a trade to make money off this?
Sally is going to apply a directional bias to this calendar structure we just built. She is going to look at the macro environment and decide if she thinks supply is going to tighten or loosen. Let's start with her deciding things are getting tight. She's going to use what we call a bull spread.
Okay, a bull spread.
Now, a crucial caveat for the listener, this specific bull spread logic we are about to discuss is built strictly on the physical storable commodity model. We are talking about grains, energy, metals, the tangible things Farmer Fred deals with.
Right, and that's because in those physical markets, the nearby month is always the most sensitive to supply and demand shocks.
Exactly. The front of the curve is where the action is. If there is a sudden supply disruption, like a pipeline explodes, a mine collapses, a drought hits, that shortage is felt immediately in the spot market, which is the nearby month.
Because everyone scrambles for what's left today.
Right. If there's a sudden surge in demand, it hits the nearby month first. Therefore, the nearby month is highly reactive and volatile. The deferred months, like 6 or 9 months out, are much more sluggish. They are anchored to future expectations of the next harvest or new supply coming online.
Okay, so speculator Sally is reading the weather reports. She's looking at export data, and she decides she is bullish. She thinks the market is getting tighter and demand is firming up. What is the actual mechanical setup of her trade?
A bull expects the nearby situation to get stronger. Therefore, the unbreakable structural rule for the exam is this. A bull spread is long the nearby month and short the deferred month.
Long nearby, short deferred. Okay, listen, I know from tutoring people that under the stress of the exam, it is incredibly easy to accidentally flip those legs in your mind. We need a visceral memory aid for this.
Let's hear it.
I want you to picture a bull, an angry, aggressive, charging bull. When a bull attacks, it leads with its horns, right? It charges out in the front.
Yeah, head down, pushing forward.
Exactly. The front of the calendar is the nearby month. Whichever animal you are picturing, you go long on the leg the animal stands on or the part of the animal that doing the attacking. The bull attacks in the front. Therefore, you go long the front month, the nearby.
That visual works perfectly. So Sally goes long the nearby May contract and short the deferred July contract. Now let's trace the mechanics of how she actually extracts a profit from that setup.
Show me the money.
She put the trade on expecting demand to firm or nearby supply to tighten. When that fundamental shift happens, as we established, the nearby leg reacts faster and moves more aggressively.
So the price of the May corn shoots up faster than the price of the July corn.
Precisely. Let's say May corn goes up by 50 cents, but July corn, being more sluggish, only goes up by 20 cents. Because May is rising faster than July, the gap between them is getting smaller. The spread narrows.
It's squishing together.
Yeah, it is moving away from the full carry ceiling and moving toward inversion. In this scenario, Sally's long leg, the May corn, made 50 cents. Mm. Her short leg, the July corn, lost 20 cents because she is short and the price went up.
Right.
So her net profit is 30 cents. That narrowing of the gap is exactly where her profit comes from.
Okay, listener, I want you to pay very close attention to this next point, because I guarantee you will see a question designed to trick you on this exact mechanism. Exam trap alert right here.
They love this trick.
The exam will give you a scenario. Speculator Sally puts on a bull spread in crude oil. She is long the nearby, short the deferred. Over the next month, the overall global macro economy slumps, and the outright flat price of crude oil drops by $2 across the board. The question we'll ask, did Sally lose money? your immediate emotional instinct is going to be to say, well, she put on a bull spread and the market went down, so obviously she lost money. Why is that instinct completely wrong?
It is wrong because the absolute flat price of the commodity is irrelevant to the spread trader. We don't have enough information from just the flat price drop to know if she won or lost. She absolutely could have made a massive profit in that falling market.
Wait, a bull spread making money in a falling market? Let's use an analogy to break this down. Think of the absolute flat price of crude oil as the tide of the ocean. It lifts or drops all the boats in the harbor together.
That's a great way to view it. If the overall tide falls, but the nearby month falls slower than the deferred month, the gap still narrows.
Let's put numbers to it so I can see it.
Okay. Suppose the market tanks. The sluggish July contract plummets by a full dollar. But the nearby May contract, because there is still relatively tight physical supply today, only drops by 50 cents. May demonstrated relative strength. It held up better.
So let's calculate Sally's P&L there. She is short the July contract, which dropped a dollar. She makes a dollar on that leg.
Right.
She is long the May contract, which dropped 50 cents. She loses 50 cents on that leg. Her net profit is 50 cents. Her bull spread just generated a significant profit in a market that was collapsing overall.
It is a profound realization when you finally grasp that. As long as the nearby month shows relative strength, meaning it rises faster in a bull market or falls slower in a bear market, the gap narrows and the bull spread is profitable. You are trading the differential, the relative performance, not the absolute price.
And if we connect this fundamental behavior back to what we explored regarding floors and ceilings, we uncover the most defining characteristic of the bull spread, which is its profit potential.
Exactly. Because Sally's profit is generated by the gap narrowing and eventually crossing zero into inversion, we have to ask, how far can it invert? And as we discussed with the impossibility of time travel, there is no floor to that inversion.
Because there is no mathematical limit to how high the nearby can spike over the deferred during a historic supply crisis, a bull spread on a physical commodity has absolutely no theoretical profit cap. The gap can invert endlessly. It could go inverted by a dollar, $10, $50.
As high as it needs to go.
Meaning Sally's potential profit is bounded only by the extremity of the physical shortage. It is an unlimited upside scenario.
Unlimited upside is what attracts speculators to the bull spread during times of geopolitical tension or weather anomalies. But markets are cyclical. Sally doesn't always think the market is tight. There are years where the weather is perfect, the supply chains are flawless, and the market is flooded with product. Which brings us to the mirror image of our strategy, bear spreads.
Let's set the scene for the bear spread. Farmer Fred just had the best year of his life. The sun shone exactly when it needed to, the rain fell perfectly, and his crop yield broke historical records.
A bumper crop.
Massive. In fact, everyone's crop yields broke records. The commercial silos are overflowing to the point where they are piling grain on the ground under massive tarps. Supply is incredibly overwhelmingly ample. Speculator Sally is analyzing this data and expects the nearby market to become extremely weak because there's just too much physical product sloshing around looking for a buyer right now.
She is formulating a bearish thesis on the relative value of the front month. So we apply our mechanical setup rule.
Let's use our memory aid again. If the bull charges out front, what does the bear do?
It stands up and leans back.
Right. The bear is heavy, slow, and tends to hang back on his hind legs. The bear's power is in the back. The back of the calendar is the deferred month. Therefore, to construct a bear spread, you go short the nearby month and long the deferred month.
Short the nearby, long the deferred. That is the foundational structure. Now, what is the mathematical trigger for her to generate a profit? A bear spread profits when the gap between the 2 months widens.
Because she's short the nearby.
Exactly. Because Sally is short the nearby contract, she actively wants the nearby month to be the weak link. She wants the sheer weight of that massive harvest to crush the nearby price.
She wants the May price to drop faster or in a rising market to rise much slower than the July price. If the nearby weakens relative to the deferred, it sinks lower and the gap between them stretches out. The spread is moving away from inversion and moving aggressively back toward full carry.
That widening action is the engine of the bear spread. Sally is cheering for that gap to stretch as far as it possibly can.
Okay, listener, I'm putting you on the spot again to see if we are connecting the dots. Sally is sitting at her desk watching the gap widen. She's making money as it widens, and she wants it to widen to infinity so she can retire to a private island. Who is going to suddenly show up, kick in the door, and completely ruin her retirement plans?
It is going to be arbitrage, Andy.
Andy ruins the party every single time.
He does, because he is bound by the laws of mathematics. A bear spread generates profit as the gap widens. But we already comprehensively proved that the widening of the gap is strictly capped by full carry, the physical cost of storage, insurance, and interest. Andy's arbitrage mechanism puts a hard, unbreakable stop on Sally's profit.
The moment that gap widens enough to hit the full carry threshold, let's say 50 cents, Andy steps in with $1 billion of institutional capital. He starts buying the nearby and selling the deferred to capture the risk-free yield. And in doing so, he forces the gap to stop widening. It hits a brick wall.
Therefore, a bear spread's maximum profit is fundamentally capped.
Completely capped. In fact, if you know the current cost of carry, you know exactly what your maximum possible profit is the very second you enter the trade. If the current gap is 20 cents and full carry is 50 cents, your absolute maximum profit on a bear spread is 30 cents. You cannot make a single penny more than that, no matter how much corn Farmer Fred produces.
This asymmetry is one of the most vital concepts in the entire curriculum.
Let's pause and actually synthesize this, because I see students confuse these profiles constantly. Let's do a deliberate side-by-side conceptual comparison. I want you to imagine a ledger in your mind. On the left side, we have the bull. On the right side, the bear.
Let's look at the bull side of the ledger. The bull charges in front. The position is long the nearby, short the deferred. The profit mechanism is the gap narrowing or pushing into inversion. The fundamental economic driver is tightening spot supply or surging immediate demand, and the profit potential. It is uncapped.
Wow.
There is no ceiling on inversion because time travel is impossible.
Boom. Now look at the bear side of the ledger. The bear hangs back on his hind legs. The position is short the nearby, long the deferred. The profit mechanism is the gap widening toward full carry. The fundamental economic driver is ample nearby supply and bursting silos. And the profit potential is strictly capped. There's a hard ceiling of full carry built by the invisible hand of arbitrage, Andy, and the physical costs of storage.
If you internalize that specific side-by-side comparison, if you understand the why behind the unlimited versus capped profit potentials, you can confidently navigate almost any standard carrying charge spread question they throw at you.
Okay, take a deep breath.
Okay.
Shake off the agricultural examples for a second. Because now we are entering the territory where the exam actively tries to trap people who have just memorized the rules without understanding the underlying logic. We're talking about financial futures.
Up until this exact moment in the episode, every single rule, every ceiling, and every floor we have established has been based on one massive underlying assumption.
Which is?
We are dealing with a physical commodity that can be stored in a warehouse. Farmer Fred's corn, crude oil in a supertanker, gold bars in a vault. The physical cost of storage, insurance, and interest is the gravitational force that creates the contango structure of the market.
Right. Gravity pulls things down, storage costs push the deferred months up. But let's change the environment. What if Farmer Fred decides farming is too stressful, sells his tractor, and decides he wants to day trade the S&P 500 stock index? Can Fred take physical delivery of the S&P 500 and store it in his living room? Can he call an insurance broker to insure his stock index futures against rats or flood damage?
He absolutely cannot. And that is the massive fundamental caveat that you must recognize. Financial futures, whether we are talking about stock index futures, treasury bonds, or foreign currencies, do not have physical storage costs in the same way agricultural products do. You do not put a stock index in a silo.
Obviously not.
You do not rent warehouse space for a treasury bond. Because there is no physical storage cost anchoring the relationship between the nearby and deferred months, the entire long nearby equals bullish logic can completely break down.
So if there are no physical storage costs dictating the gap in financial spreads, what is the mathematical anchor? What drives the gap between a June S&P 500 contract and a September S&P 500 contract?
The driver shifts entirely from physical logistics to the cost of capital. For financial futures, the cost of carry is essentially a calculation of interest rates minus yield. Let's look at the S&P 500. If you buy the actual stocks in the index, you have to tie up your capital, which means you are paying an opportunity cost or an actual interest rate on borrowed money.
Right.
However, those stocks also pay dividends. Those dividends are a yield that offset your interest costs.
Oh, I see. So it's a financial tug of war. The interest rate pulls the deferred cost up, but the dividend yield pulls it down.
Exactly. And because of this entirely different mathematical foundation, financial futures can behave in what seems like reverse compared to physical commodities. In a roaring, aggressive bull market for the S&P 500, investors are highly optimistic about future corporate earnings and dividend growth. In that environment, the deferred month might actually pull away and widen its lead over the nearby month. rather than narrowing the gap.
Because everyone wants the future growth.
Yes. The expectations for future growth outpace the current spot dynamics.
So if you blindly apply the physical commodity rule, I'm bullish, so I want the gap to narrow, and you bought the nearby S&P contract and shorted the deferred, you might get absolutely crushed in a raging bull market because the deferred is actually the leg gaining value faster based on forward expectations.
That is exactly what happens. Without the physical anchor of a grain silo, the front month volatility assumption doesn't universally hold true.
This is an exam trap alert, and it might be the most important one of the deep dive. The practical rule for the exam is this. You must read the prompt carefully. Do not just scan the question, see the word bullish, and instantly select the multiple choice answer that says long nearby. You have to identify the underlying asset first. If the question explicitly states it is a physical storable commodity like wheat, copper, or crude oil, you use the standard model we just spent 30 minutes dissecting. Bull means long nearby.
But if the question explicitly flags a stock index future, a currency, or explicitly uses the phrase non-storable market, you have to hit the brakes. You cannot use a blanket rule. In those questions, you have to read the rest of the scenario to see which specific leg the text tells you is expected to move faster before you assign a directional label like bull or bear. The physical rules simply do not universally apply to financial instruments.
Think of it like the laws of physics. The rules of gravity work perfectly on Earth. If you drop an apple, it falls. That's our physical commodity market. But if the exam suddenly puts you in zero gravity on the International Space Station, which is our financial futures market, things might float in reverse or behave entirely differently. Just check your environment before you answer. Is it a storable physical asset or a non-storable financial asset?
Context is absolutely everything in part one of the series three.
All right, let's keep this momentum going because we're about to switch the variables entirely. Let's jump into intermarket spreads. Up until now, we've only been playing with time.
Yes. Everything we've discussed from minute one of this deep dive has been a spread using the exact same commodity in different delivery months. May corn versus July corn, December gold versus February gold. The underlying asset was constant. The variable was time. Now we are flipping the script. What if speculator Sally wants to trade different commodities, but she wants to eliminate the variable of time by trading them in the exact same delivery lot?
That structural setup is called an intermarket spread. Inter, meaning between. Between two different but related markets. You are long one commodity and you are short a completely different commodity. And to keep the analysis clean and eliminate the carrying charge variables we just learned, these spreads are almost always constructed using the same delivery month. So for example, you are long May soybeans and you are short May corn.
And because we have fundamentally changed the variables of the trade, the economic driver of the gap between them completely changes. This is no longer about Farmer Fred paying for warehouse space, insurance premiums, or interest. Storage costs are utterly irrelevant in this specific trade because both legs expire in the exact same month.
Right. If you are holding a long position in May beans and a short position in May corn, the timeline is identical. You hold them both until May. The storage duration is a wash. So if storage isn't creating the price gap, what is actually driving the relative value between soybeans and corn?
It is driven by real-world economic relationships, substitution effects, and processing margins. Think about the psychology of Farmer Fred when he is sitting at his kitchen table in the winter deciding what to plant in the spring.
He's making a business choice.
Exactly. He has a fund amount of acreage. He can plant corn or he can plant soybeans. He looks at the futures prices. If the price of soybeans is incredibly high relative to the price of corn, Fred is going to look at his empty fields and say, "I'm planting soybeans this year because the profit margin is better."
And when millions of farmers all make that exact same economically rational decision, it causes a massive shift in the future supply of both products. They overplant soybeans, which will eventually drive the bean price down, and they underplant corn, which will eventually drive the corn price up. The intermarket spread is trading that exact economic tug of war.
Let's get specific, because the exam material highlights a few named examples of intermarket spreads that you absolutely need to recognize. The first broad category is related grains.
The classic textbook example of this is the soybean corn spread, or you might see the wheat corn spread. These commodities are intimately related because they compete for the exact same agricultural acreage, and in some cases, they compete as substitutes in livestock feed.
Right. If corn gets too expensive, you feed the cows wheat.
Exactly. A speculator trading this spread is making a macroeconomic bet on which crop is going to gain relative value over the other. They're analyzing planting intentions reports for the USDA, specific weather patterns that affect one crop more than the other, or shifting global export demand.
And the second major example the exam focuses on is even more mechanically specific. It's an intermarket spread called a product spread, more commonly referred to on the trading floor as the crush.
The crush spread is fascinating because it moves away from just planting acreage and gets into the actual industrial machinery of the commodities world. It's built entirely around a processing margin. Let's look at the soybean complex. Humans don't generally eat raw soybeans in mass quantities.
No, we don't.
A massive industrial processing plant buys the raw commodity, the soybeans. They crush those beans in a factory, and they extract two distinct finished products. Soybean meal, which is a high-protein feed used for livestock and poultry, and soybean oil, which is used for human cooking and increasingly for biodiesel fuel.
So when a trader puts on a crush spread, they are essentially mimicking the economics of that factory on their trading screen. To replicate the factory's cash flow, you go long the raw material, the soybeans. You are buying the input. And simultaneously, you go short the processed outputs. You short the soybean meal and short the soybean oil. You are selling the finished goods.
It's brilliant. When you put on a crush spread, you don't actually care if the global price of soybeans doubles or gets cut in half. You are completely insulated from the flat price. You are strictly betting on the profitability of the processing plant. You are betting that the price of the finished meal and oil will remain higher than the cost of the raw beans. You are trading the profit margin.
Exactly. You are isolating the industrial margin. The Board of Trade even establishes specific contract ratios for this to mimic the physical yield of a bushel of beans, though you don't necessarily need to memorize the exact ratio of beans to meal to oil for the baseline questions. You just need to understand the mechanism. You are trading the input against the outputs.
And just to ensure we cover all our bases, because the exam loves to test inversions of concepts, if you flip that entire structure, if you go short the raw beans and long the meal and oil, that's called a reverse crush. You might do that if you think the processing plants have overproduced and the margin is going to collapse.
Correct. The overarching testable takeaway for all of these intermarket spreads, whether it's wheat versus corn or the soybean crush, is that the gap is driven by supply, demand, substitution, and industrial processing margins. It is never driven by the physical cost of storage.
Okay, because that distinction is so vital, I want to do one more deliberate side-by-side comparison for you, the listener.
Yeah.
This is a massive point of failure for test takers who get overwhelmed by the terminology. If I sit down next to you and say, I'm trading a gap spread today, how do you instantly diagnose which set of mathematical rules applies? Calendar or intermarket?
It completely comes down to identifying the variables in the trade structure. You have to look at the legs.
Let's break it down as clearly as possible. Listen closely.
If the two legs of the trade are the exact same commodity, but they expire in different months, like May wheat versus July wheat, that is a carrying charge spread, also known as a calendar spread. What is the fundamental force driving the gap between those prices? It is the cost of carry, storage, insurance, and interest.
Okay, and the other one?
If the two legs of the trade are different commodities, but they expire in the exact same month, like May wheat versus May corn, that is an intermarket spread. What is the fundamental force driving the gap there? It is product-to-product economic relationships, planting acreage, global supply and demand imbalances, and industrial processing margins.
If you take nothing else away from this episode, remember this specific exam trap. Do not cross the streams of logic. The exam will deliberately give you a scenario outlining a soybean-corn spread. It will then ask you what primary factor is driving the price differential. And I guarantee you, one of the multiple choice answers will be the cost of carry or storage costs. If you see that, run away.
Don't click it.
Do not apply cost of carry storage reasoning to an intermarket spread. The driver is entirely different. It's an economic link, not a logistical storage link.
That is exactly how they catch the underprepared candidates. They rely on you reading the word spread and having your brain blindly default to the storage rules because they are the most common. You have to actively identify the type of spread before you apply the rule.
Okay, we have covered an immense, frankly exhausting amount of ground today. We've been in Farmer Fred's compromised living room, analyzing storage costs. We've watched speculator Sally place directional relative value bets on the shape of the curve. And we've seen arbitrage Andy police the market by building a mathematical ceiling out of institutional capital.
It's been quite a journey.
Rather than just throwing a rapid-fire trivia quiz at you to end the deep dive, I want to synthesize everything we've learned by walking through the complete life cycle of a single trop. Let's trace how all these concepts interact in the real world over a season.
I think that's the best way to solidify the mechanics. Let's start in the winter.
Okay, it's winter. The silos are relatively full from the previous harvest. The market is calm. The structure is a normal carrying charge market. The deferred months are higher than the nearby months, perfectly reflecting the cost of storage, insurance, and interest. Arbitrage Andy is asleep at the wheel because nothing is out of whack.
Then spring arrives and the seeds go into the ground. But suddenly, a historic drought hits the Midwest. The market realizes the upcoming harvest is going to be terrible. Spot demand panics. Speculator Sally sees this and initiates a bull spread. She buys the nearby, shorts the deferred.
Because of the drought, the nearby month skyrockets faster than the deferred. The gap narrows. Sally's bull spread starts printing money. The panic intensifies, and the market crosses zero. It becomes inverted. The nearby is now more expensive than the deferred.
And remember, there's no floor.
There's no floor to this inversion because time travel doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Sally's profits run to theoretically unlimited levels as the physical shortage drives buyers to pay literally anything for immediate delivery.
But eventually the cycle corrects. The high prices cure the high prices. Demand destruction occurs. People stop buying beef because it's too expensive, so livestock producers stop buying corn. Then the next planting season arrives. The weather is perfect. A record-breaking harvest is expected.
Sally sees the massive harvest coming. She flips her strategy. She initiates a bear spread. She shorts the nearby, longs the deferred. The massive weight of the new physical crop hits the spot market. The nearby price collapses relative to the deferred. The inversion disappears, and the gap widens back out, moving steadily toward full carry.
Sally is making money on the widening gap, but the gap eventually hits 50 cents, the exact physical cost of storage. Arbitrage Andy wakes up. He unleashes his institutional capital, buying the physical cash and selling the futures, locking in the risk-free yield. His massive trades build an unbreakable ceiling. The gap stops widening.
So her profit stops growing.
Yes. Sally's bear spread profit hits its strict hard cap, and the market has returned to a normal carrying charge structure.
That is the beautiful, brutal, cyclical machinery of the futures market. If you can visualize that life cycle, you understand spreads on a fundamental level that rote memorization can never achieve.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final, slightly provocative conceptual thought to chew on as you continue studying. We spent a lot of time today talking about how a bull spread on a physical commodity has no theoretical profit cap.
Right. The unlimited upside.
The mathematical models dictate that if a supply squeeze is severe enough, the nearby month can invert infinitely. It could theoretically go $100, $1,000, or $1 million over the deferred month.
Because there's no floor. You can't time travel physical corn to solve a spot shortage. The math is absolute.
Exactly. The spreadsheet allows for infinite profit. But I want you to think about this. What actually happens to the psychology and structure of a real-world market when an inversion gets that extreme? If the nearby spot price is so absurdly mathematically high, at what point do the commercial producers, the actual physical players who signed legal contracts to deliver physical goods, just start defaulting?
It becomes a purely economic decision for them. They look at the financial penalty for breaking the delivery contract, and they realize it is actually massively cheaper to accept the default penalty and ruin their reputation than it is to buy the commodity in the open spot market at the artificially inflated inverted price just to deliver it.
Right. The textbook math says infinite profit for the speculator on the screen. But out in the real world, at a certain pressure point, the physical reality of the supply chain just snaps. The actual mechanics of the market break down entirely. When defaults start cascading, the exchange itself has to step in, halt trading, declare a force majeure, or force cash liquidations to prevent the entire financial system from imploding.
It happens.
It is a vital reminder that while we study these perfect, frictionless mathematical models for the exam, and you absolutely must answer the questions based strictly on the models to pass, The real world has a breaking point where human behavior and physical logistics override the spreadsheet.
That's a great perspective to have.
Keep that physical reality in mind as you study. These aren't just abstract numbers floating on a screen. They represent the actual physical realities holding the global economy together. Until next time, keep studying hard. Trust your structural logic over your directional emotions and go crush that exam.